A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hey, Herman and Corin. I'd love to chat today again about the question of rentals here in Israel, because this is just such an issue that the more I think about it, it's not just like a social problem. It's a societal poison that is affecting people around the world. And it's just a massive drain. I'm talking about how buying property has become very challenging. And here in Israel, and I'm thinking that this isn't, we're not unique, which is why I share these stories so freely, openly, and repetitively, that we have a totally dysfunctional rental market. My wife and I, we're both in our late 30s, we're currently trudging around Jerusalem with our 10-month-old son, going to viewings, most of which make the photos that were displayed look like they were cooked up in Hollywood. And sometimes we're even seeing there's a new trend here. The photos display, the photos in the listings say, generated with AI for display, for illustrative purposes only. It's crazy. And we're basically trying to find a new place to live, our current place. We were hoping that we would get on the property ladder, at least a starter place, from our current rental. And fate had a different decision, I guess. There was this big leak. Landlord did not fix it. And when we had the temerity after weeks of living with a leak in our apartment and sleeping on our sofa to ask when might the leak be fixed, the next day received a very hostile email telling us that our tenancy would not be renewed. So basically, and the thing is, that's legal in Israel. So we find ourselves shifting our energy now towards spending our weekends looking at apartments, which is not how we would like to be spending our Friday. We're between viewings as I record this, in fact. Here's what I'd love to get to in this particular conversation. There's a few dynamics that really stick out when you're going to viewings, and we've been to countless viewings in our careers as renters here. There's a few things. Number one is societal attitudes, which is that the attitude that prevails in Israel is that if you're renting in your 30s, you're doing something really wrong. After our last move, when the movers charged us $2,500 to move our possessions, said with a stern look, "I hope this is your last move. Come on, buy already." Or when we talked about our leak fiasco with the lawyer we hired, she said the same thing, just buy. And it's strange, there's this massive disconnect between this generation of Israelis and us, where we kind of think, do they not realize that property is like, it costs like $1 million to buy a basic place here and get on the property ladder? And the thing is, they don't. There's a huge just awareness gap. But it's much more than that. When you dive into the what's going on in Israel with property, you realize that property is primarily thought of as an investment vehicle, as a passive income generator. And so frequently we show up to these viewings and, you know, after a few minutes, sometimes the person, it might be a family member showing the property, and they'll tell you, yeah, this is, my dad has a few places in Jerusalem. And the dad might be a taxi driver or, you know, some occupation that you kind of scratch your head wondering, how did this person get to the point that they own an entire fleet of property scattered throughout Israel? And that's often the case. You'll find a lot of families have three or four properties, which gives them a second home and a couple of places to pass down. There's also a huge tradition because of this generational disparity of gifting property to family members. There's a, you know, commonly you'll see young couples, it's kind of an expectation that the family will gift you an apartment when you get married. So I think everywhere there's just been this massive disconnect or this massive rapid degrading in purchasing power that accounts for how hard it is to get on the property ladder And in Israel, we have these additional localized factors, which is what I'd love to discuss in this episode. Namely, that the version I've been told is that property used to be really cheap, and a lot of people just got in on it at that point, bought up a lot of places, rapidly appreciated, which then creates this sort of, I guess, societal belief that this is what property is for. It's not a place to live in so much as it is as a wealth generation vehicle. And then on the back of Israel's immigrant population of Jewish immigrants like me, we're the people who are funding that. I can't say this without kind of feeling a bit disgusted by how Zionism has been sort of perverted to this end, but it does seem to me like a very stark, this wasn't how it was supposed to be thing. We also can't evade the political dimension here, because anyone who's not in Israel would probably listen to this and say, this guy is complaining about the fact that property here is unaffordable because previous generations basically hoarded property that they themselves, grabbed from whoever was on the land before. And I don't think that that's exactly what's happening necessarily, but there is that element as well of, if we're talking about how was property handed out at a certain point in time in the history of the state of Israel, we probably do have to look at the question of ownership, and we can't avoid that part of the narrative, in other words. Herman and Corin, let's talk about what's going on here with property in Israel. For those who are trudging around viewings like me, hearing about taxi drivers who own 4 properties and they're happy to rent out one to you that you can barely afford, it seems like it's a head scratcher. We're like, what has gone on in this place? Give us the lowdown based upon what you can find on the internet.
We got a prompt from Daniel, and it opens with what might be the most 2026 sentence I've ever read. He and his wife are apartment hunting in Jerusalem with their 10-month-old son, and the listings now include photos labeled generated with AI for illustrative purposes only.
The AI apartment. You're not even looking at a real room anymore. You're looking at what a room could look like if someone bothered to stage it, which they didn't.
The reason they're hunting at all is that their landlord evicted them. Not for non-payment, not for property damage. For asking when a leak might get fixed.
After weeks of sleeping on their sofa because the bedroom was uninhabitable, they asked the question, and the next day, a hostile email saying the tenancy won't be renewed. Completely legal in Israel.
That's tenancy at will. The landlord doesn't need a reason. They can simply decide not to renew after the initial lease period, and you're out. No cause required.
Here's why this isn't just one family's bad luck. The Central Bureau of Statistics released data this month showing Israel's rent-to-income ratio hit 38%. That's up from 28% in 2019.
38%. For context, anything above 30% is what economists call rent-burdened. At 38, you're not just burdened, you're being slowly crushed.
This is May 2026. The war with Iran is on day 74, the shekel's been volatile, and yet housing prices haven't corrected. They've actually ticked up another 2% in the last quarter.
The prompt lands at this intersection of personal crisis and systemic failure. Daniel and his wife are in their late 30s, both professionals, and they're spending their Fridays trudging between AI-faked listings, hearing about taxi drivers who own 4 apartments, getting stern lectures from movers about how they should just buy already.
The 2 most infuriating words in the Israeli housing conversation.
What Daniel's really asking is, what happened here? How did Israel build a rental market where tenants have almost no rights, where property functions primarily as a wealth vehicle for people who got in early, and where the cultural expectation is that you should own by 30 while the math makes that impossible for most?
Let's unpack what's actually going on here, because this isn't just one family's bad luck. It's a systemic failure with 4 distinct dynamics: the societal attitudes, property as an investment vehicle, the degradation of purchasing power, and the political dimension that nobody wants to talk about but that we can't avoid.
I think the place to start is that disconnect Daniel keeps running into. The movers, the lawyers, the family members all saying just buy, while the numbers say buying requires roughly $500,000 for a basic 3-room apartment in Jerusalem or Tel Aviv.
72% of Israelis aged 25 to 34 live with their parents. That's 2025 CBS data. Nearly 3/4 of young adults can't afford to move out, and yet the cultural script hasn't updated. The expectation is still that you own by 30.
The script is frozen in 1995, when a three-room apartment cost about 5 times the median salary. Today, it's 15 times. The math changed, the attitudes didn't.
That gap between the frozen cultural expectation and the brutal economic reality is where a lot of the poison lives. That gap between the frozen cultural expectation and the brutal economic reality is where a lot of the poison lives.
What's striking is that this isn't just a market failure. It's a category error on a societal scale. Israel treats housing as a financial asset first and a basic need second, and that ordering distorts everything downstream.
That's exactly the framing. When you treat an apartment primarily as a wealth vehicle, the incentives align around appreciation, not habitability. The landlord who evicted Daniel for asking about a leak, that's not a glitch in the system. That's the system working as designed. The landlord's priority is protecting the asset's value, and a tenant who makes demands is a liability.
The tenant, in this framework, isn't a customer buying a service. They're a temporary occupant whose rent payments are servicing someone else's mortgage while they absorb all the downside risk.
What is this really about? It's about a system where housing has been financialized to the point that renting isn't just expensive. It's structurally designed to keep you renting. Every mechanism, from the tax code to the legal framework to the cultural narrative, pushes in the same direction.
The four dynamics Daniel flagged: societal attitudes, property as investment, purchasing power degradation, and the political dimension, they're not four separate problems. They're four layers of the same problem, stacked on top of each other.
They reinforce each other. The investment mindset drives prices up, which degrades purchasing power, which makes buying impossible, which creates a permanent renter class, which society then stigmatizes as personal failure rather than structural outcome.
The stigma is the cheapest enforcement mechanism. You don't need to pass laws keeping people in their place when shame does the work for free.
When we get into the specifics, the tax incentives, the land authority, the immigration funding loops, you start to see that none of this happened by accident. Each layer was a policy choice.
Choices with beneficiaries. The taxi driver with four apartments isn't a villain. He responded rationally to incentives that were deliberately structured to produce exactly that outcome.
Let's walk through each of those four layers, starting with the one that hits Daniel every time he shows up at a viewing. That first layer, the societal attitudes, is where the absurdity really lives. You've got 72% of 25 to 34-year-olds living with their parents, and yet the mover looks at a professional couple in their late 30s and says, "Just buy already," with a straight face.
The mover charging them $2,500 for the privilege of being lectured. That's the Israeli rental experience in one transaction.
It's not just the movers. The lawyer they hired about the leak, same reflex. As if they hadn't considered that. As if the $500,000 price tag for a basic three-room apartment in Jerusalem was just a minor detail they'd overlooked.
What's fascinating is the awareness gap Daniel describes. The people saying, "just buy," genuinely don't seem to know what property costs now. They're operating on mental price tags from 15 years ago.
Because they bought 15 years ago. The taxi driver with four apartments, he bought his first one in 1998 when prices were still grounded. Then he refinanced, bought another in 2003, and by the time prices started going vertical around 2008, his equity was doing the work for him. He hasn't looked at a listing price as an actual buyer in decades.
You get this bifurcated reality. One group for whom property is something you accumulated when it was cheap, and another group for whom it's something you'll never accumulate, because the entry price is now 15 times your salary.
The first group keeps dispensing advice to the second group as if the conditions haven't changed. It's like someone who bought Apple stock in 1997 telling you to just save up and do the same.
The stigma serves a function, though. If renting in your 30s is a personal moral failing, then nobody has to examine the structural conditions that make buying impossible. The shame privatizes the problem.
And it connects directly to the second dynamic, property as an investment vehicle. Because the reason the taxi driver owns four apartments isn't that he's unusually savvy. It's that the entire tax code is built to make property the most attractive investment in the country.
Walk me through the mechanics on that. How does a taxi driver end up with a property portfolio?
Section 12.2 of the Tax Ordinance. This is the big one. If you own residential property and you rent it out, you can deduct 10% of the property's value annually as depreciation, no receipts required. It's an automatic deduction that assumes your building is losing value every year, even when it's actually appreciating.
The tax code pretends your asset is depreciating, while the market ensures it's appreciating. You get the deduction and the gain.
And there's more. Rental income up to a certain threshold, around 5,000 shekels per month per unit, is tax exempt. So a landlord with four apartments renting each at 4,500 shekels pays zero tax on that income.
18,000 shekels a month, tax-free, plus depreciation deductions, plus the underlying asset appreciating at 5 to 8% annually. That's not an investment. That's a money printer.
Compare that to what a tenant faces. The tenant pays rent with after-tax income, gets no deductions, builds no equity, and can be evicted without cause. The asymmetry is total.
The 2011 social protests were supposed to address some of this. 500,000 Israelis in the streets, tents on Rothschild Boulevard, the whole country talking about housing costs.
What came out of it? The buyer's price program, which was a demand-side subsidy. The government said, here's discounted land for first-time buyers. But it didn't increase overall supply, it just gave a subset of buyers a leg up in bidding wars. Prices kept rising.
There was a temporary rent control measure too, right?
The 2011 protests produced a limited rent stabilization framework, but it was gutted by 2015. The landlord lobby argued it would discourage investment in rental housing, and the Knesset bought that argument. So we ended up with the worst of both worlds. No rent control, but also no significant new rental supply, because the incentives still favor selling units, not renting them.
That brings us to the third thing Daniel flagged, which is this new trend of AI-generated listing photos. I have to say, this one really got me.
It's such a perfect encapsulation of where the market is. Landlords are now using generative AI to stage empty apartments, furniture, lighting, sometimes even views from the windows, and the photos are labeled generated with AI for illustrative purposes only.
Which sounds like a disclaimer, but it's actually a shield. If the apartment looks nothing like the photos, well, they told you. You were warned.
Think about what this does to the information asymmetry that already exists. In a normal rental market, you visit an apartment, you see what you're getting. In Israel, you're already dealing with a market that has no national rental registry, no requirement to disclose previous rent amounts, no standardized lease terms. Now you add AI-generated photos that make a crumbling three-room in Katamon look like a Tel Aviv penthouse.
It's not just misleading. It's a time tax. You're spending your Fridays driving across Jerusalem to see apartments that were never going to look like the photos, because the photos weren't photos.
The landlord's incentive is clear. More viewings means more competition, which means higher rent. The AI photos are a lead generation tool, and they work even if the apartment disappoints, because by the time you're standing there, you've already invested the time.
The sunk cost of the viewing. You've schlepped across town with a 10-month-old. You're there. Maybe you lower your standards just to make the trip feel worth it.
And this connects back to why Israel's rental market is so dysfunctional at a structural level. There's no national rental registry. In Germany, you can look up what the previous tenant paid. In Israel, you're guessing. The landlord can quote any number, and you have no way to verify whether it's reasonable.
No registry, no rent stabilization, and tenant protections that are among the weakest in the OECD. I saw a 2024 OECD housing report that ranked Israel near the bottom on tenant security. Only the US and a couple of others were comparably landlord-friendly.
The broker fee structure is the cherry on top. Tenants pay 1 month's rent plus VAT 17% to a broker the landlord hired. That's roughly $2,000 added to every move. The landlord gets the service. The tenant pays for it.
I've said this before, but it really is the perfect symbol of everything wrong with the market. The person with the power and the asset pays nothing. The person with no power and no asset pays for the privilege of being allowed to rent.
The leak eviction Daniel described. That's legal because of how tenancy at will works in Israel. After the initial lease period, usually 1 year, the landlord can simply choose not to renew. No cause required, no explanation, no recourse. Asking about a leak isn't a protected activity. It's just a reason for the landlord to find a less demanding tenant.
That's the trade-off in this system. Landlords get maximum flexibility, tenants get maximum insecurity, and the official justification is that heavy-handed regulation would scare off investors and reduce the rental supply.
Which might be a compelling argument if the rental supply were adequate, but it's not. The vacancy rate in Jerusalem is below 2%. There's no slack. Landlords have all the leverage because there's nowhere else to go.
You got a market where the photos are fake, the broker is paid by the wrong party, the rent is opaque, the lease is fragile, and the cultural message is that you're a failure for participating in it.
That's before we even get to the historical and political layers, which is where it gets even more complicated.
Let's dig into that historical layer. You mentioned the Bank of Israel's low interest policy. Walk me through how that connects to Daniel standing in a fake photo apartment on a Friday afternoon.
The short version is that from 2014 to 2022, the Bank of Israel kept interest rates near zero. Mortgage rates dropped below 3%. When borrowing is that cheap, buyers can bid more for the same apartment. So prices go up, not because the apartment got better, but because the monthly payment stayed the same on a bigger loan.
Cheap money, chasing the same number of walls.
In 1995, a three-room apartment in Jerusalem cost about 5 times the median salary. By 2026, it's 15 times. That's not just population growth or immigration. That's the price of money driving the price of everything else.
When rates finally went up in 2023 through 2026, prices didn't correct.
Israel completes about 55,000 new housing units a year. Demand is closer to 65,000. That gap has been running for over a decade. When rates rise, developers slow construction rather than cut prices because they know the shortage isn't going anywhere. So you get the worst outcome. Higher mortgage costs and stubbornly high prices.
Which makes the monthly payment even worse. You're borrowing at 6% to buy an asset, inflated by the years of borrowing at 2%.
If you're renting, you're paying rent that tracks those inflated asset values because landlords set rent based on what the unit costs them, not on what a tenant earns. That's how you get the 38% rent-to-income ratio we cited earlier.
Now Daniel mentions something specific about immigrants funding this whole machine. What's the mechanism there?
Since the 1990s, Israel absorbed well over 1 million immigrants from the former Soviet Union. New immigrants arrive with what's called an absorption basket, government grants, rental subsidies, and critically, mortgage guarantees. The state effectively co-signs their loan.
The government is pumping guaranteed purchasing power into the housing market, year after year.
That money flows directly into landlords' pockets. An immigrant family arrives, rents for a year or two using subsidies, then buys using a state-backed mortgage. The landlord who sold them that apartment now has capital to buy another one. The cycle compounds.
Daniel described this as Zionism being perverted to an end. It wasn't meant to serve. That's strong language.
It is, but I understand the frustration. The original vision of Zionism included collective land ownership, agricultural cooperatives, the whole kibbutz ethos. Housing was a national project, not a speculative asset. The Israel Land Authority was created to keep 93% of the land in public hands, specifically to prevent the kind of land speculation that had displaced Jews in Europe.
Now that same land authority is part of the problem.
Unintentionally, but yes. The ILA controls 93% of Israel's land. It releases land through long-term leases, typically 99 years, rather than selling it outright. The idea was to prevent a landed aristocracy from forming. But the leasehold system created a two-tier market. Leasehold land is cheaper to acquire but harder to finance because banks prefer freehold as collateral.
Everyone who can chases freehold.
Which is only 7% of the land. That tiny sliver of privately owned land, mostly in Tel Aviv and central Israel, becomes the site of ferocious bidding wars. The ILA inadvertently concentrated demand onto the scarcest asset class in the country.
That's where the 40% non-resident investor figure comes in.
A 2025 Knesset report found that 40% of apartments in Tel Aviv are owned by investors who don't live in them. Compare that to Berlin, where it's about 15%. Tel Aviv has become a global safe deposit box, and the people who actually live and work there are competing with capital part from abroad.
Berlin, at least, has rent control. They cap increases and require disclosure of previous rent. Israel has neither.
The comparison to Canada is instructive. Canada has a similar investor-driven market, Vancouver and Toronto especially. But Canada has the CMHC, the Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation, which caps mortgage insurance and imposes stress tests on borrowers. Israel has no equivalent demand-side constraint. No stress test, no loan-to-value cap that meaningfully constrains investor buyers.
An investor with three properties can keep leveraging to buy a fourth, while a young family can't get into their first.
The investor has equity to borrow against. The family has income and a prayer. And the tax code we discussed, Section 12.2, makes sure the investor keeps winning.
It all stacks. The land authority restricting supply, the immigration pipeline pumping demand, the tax code rewarding accumulation, the absence of rent control, the lack of a rental registry. Each piece reinforces the others.
The political dimension Daniel raised, we can't ignore it. The land question in Israel isn't just economic. It's tied up with the history of the state, with who owned what before 1948, with the distribution of land after statehood, and with the ongoing territorial questions.
Daniel said anyone outside Israel would hear his complaint and say, well, previous generations hoarded property. They grabbed from whoever was on the land before.
It's more complicated than that, but he's right that we can't avoid the narrative. Much of the land that became privately held in Israel after 1948 was absentee property, land owned by Palestinians who fled or were displaced during the war. The state took custody of it and eventually transferred some to private hands through various mechanisms.
The people who bought in cheap in the 1950s and 60s weren't all buying stolen land, but some of the land had a complicated provenance, and the system that made it cheap to acquire was built on a foundation that not everyone consented to.
That history compounds the present frustration. You're a young Israeli family in 2026, paying half your income in rent to a landlord who inherited an apartment his grandfather bought for nothing in 1955, on land whose ownership history is politically charged, and you're told by the mover that you're a failure for not having done the same.
It's not just an economic problem, it's a legitimacy problem. When the housing market makes no sense to the people living in it, they start questioning the whole arrangement.
Where does that leave someone standing in an apartment with AI-generated photos, a lease that expires in 60 days, and a mover who just told them to buy already? Let's get practical.
Because the structural stuff matters. But you've got a leak in the ceiling today. What can you actually do?
First thing, and this is one most tenants don't know, Israel's 2017 Tenancy Law, Amendment 10, gives tenants the right to deduct repair costs from rent if the landlord doesn't fix essential problems within 14 days of written notice. Essential includes leaks, mold, electrical hazards, heating failures. You document the problem, you notify in writing, you wait 14 days, and if nothing happens, you get it fixed yourself and deduct it from the next payment.
The key word is written. A WhatsApp message counts, but an email with a read receipt is better. And take photos. Before, during, after.
Most tenants don't exercise this right because they're afraid of retaliation. Which is rational, given what happened with the leak eviction. But the law does provide that shield, and knowing it exists changes the power dynamic, even if you're negotiating rather than deducting.
For the bigger picture, for anyone listening who's frustrated with the system as a whole, there's the tenants' union, Igud HaSokerim. They've been organizing rent strikes since 2023, mostly in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, targeting landlords who impose steep increases without justification.
They've had some success. A building in Florentin got a 30% increase rolled back to 8% last year after a coordinated withholding campaign. It's not a revolution, but it's a start.
On the policy side, the solution isn't more demand-side subsidies. First-time buyer grants just get priced into the market within months. The 2024 rent-to-own pilot in Beersheba is the better model. The ILA released land specifically for rental-only developments, long-term leases with capped increases, and a path to ownership after 5 years.
It's supply-side thinking. Build rental stock that can't be flipped to investors, on land that's already public. Scale that beyond Beersheba and you actually move the needle.
For listeners outside Israel, check whether your city has a rental registry. If it doesn't, ask why. If your landlord can raise rent without showing what the previous tenant paid, you're operating in the dark. Information asymmetry is the landlord's best friend.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The 2026 Rental Market Regulation Bill, Herman, it stalled in the Knesset Economic Committee. CPI plus 1% cap on annual increases. 60-day notice for non-renewal. Is it going anywhere, or is this another piece of paper?
The committee chair, Michael Byton, has said publicly he wants it passed by the winter session. But the Builders Association is lobbying hard against it, and they've got allies in the coalition. The cap is the sticking point. Landlords say CPI plus 1% doesn't track their actual costs, which is a weak argument when Section 122 already lets them deduct 10% of the property value annually without receipts. They're double-dipping and complaining about the margins.
The bill's fate depends on whether the coalition cares more about renters than about property-owning donors.
Which is why it stalled. But here's the thing. Even if it passes, enforcement is the real question. Israel has no rental registry. Without knowing what the previous tenant paid, a CPI plus 1% cap is unverifiable. You'd need the registry first, and that's a separate legislative fight.
The bill as written is a promise without a mechanism.
It's a start. But renters shouldn't hold their breath.
What about the AI-generated listing problem? If those become standard, how does anyone verify what they're signing up for?
That's the new frontier of information asymmetry. Right now, the only defense is physically visiting the apartment, which Daniel's doing, dragging a 10-month-old across Jerusalem on Fridays. But even that has limits. AI can stage photos, but it can't hide a leak or bad plumbing.
Could blockchain-based rental histories help? A verified, tamper-proof record of what every unit rented for, what repairs were done, what the previous tenant actually experienced.
Estonia's already experimenting with something like this for property records. But the obstacle isn't technical. It's that landlords have no incentive to participate in a system that reduces their informational advantage. Transparency is good for tenants, bad for landlords who benefit from opacity.
You'd need regulation to mandate it. Which brings us back to the stalled bill.
Everything in this market comes back to the same loop. No registry, no transparency, no constraint on rent increases, no constraint on investor accumulation. Break one link and the others start to weaken. But breaking the first link requires political will that hasn't materialized yet.
One thing I keep thinking about, we've spent this episode diagnosing a housing market that treats shelter as an asset class. But the people inside it, the renters, the young families, the immigrants, they're not abstractions. They're sleeping on sofas because the landlord won't fix a leak.
That's the open question we're left with. Will the system adjust before the social contract frays completely? The rent strike suggests people are done waiting. The stalled bill suggests the system isn't listening yet.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping the lights on.
If you want more episodes like this one, leave us a review wherever you're listening. It helps more than you'd think.
I'm Corn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. We'll catch you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from long ear. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.